the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, as we said in talking about the beginning and the end, and it's probably going to last for another 5 billion years or so. Thus, we stand at about the midpoint of this vast span of geological time. Recorded history covers only a very few thousand years. To illustrate this disparity, let's imagine again that geological time is measured on a 24-hour clock, with the present time being high noon. Each second on this clock represents 100,000 years. Let's see what's happened. The time is 4 a.m. Not much has happened during the first 4 hours except for surface cooling and rock formation. Between 4 and 5 a.m., the first microscopic life appears and an oxygen atmosphere develops. About 11 o'clock, the first plants appear, and by 11:15, there are both fish and ferns. About 11:30, reptiles appear on the scene, and by 11:40, great dinosaurs rule the world. About 8 minutes before noon, the first mammals appear, and 2 seconds before noon, primitive human beings enter the picture. Recorded history begins about 5/100ths of a second ago. The Declaration of Independence was signed 2 milliseconds before noon. What's going to happen during the next 12 hours until midnight? Human beings who have lived only 2 seconds will probably be around for several hours yet. What about the natural resources upon which life depends? What about the minerals, the fossil fuels, the oxygen, the water, and the other things that we need for life? During the past century, man has probably changed the surface of the Earth as much as it changed during the previous 100,000 centuries. We will go down in history as the generation that consumed, destroyed, and squandered the supply of fuels and minerals, which could have been shared by men of all generations, could have been shared with humans for millions of years to come. I hang my head in shame. The ethics of this overuse are very clear. If our overuse is not actually stealing, it's certainly coveting something that is not ours. The commandments tell us clearly that it is a sin against God's law to do so. The church is an institution, and we as individual Christians ought to be leading the movement to change this national disgrace. Jesus Christ, during his earthly ministry, spoke out strongly against the social and political evils of his day. I'm certain that if he were here on the planet Earth today, he'd be preaching against the squander of our natural resources. Well, this afternoon I want to focus on the conservation and use of energy. Although energy sources are only one facet of our natural resources, they are the one which is most on our mind perhaps at the present, because we're at an important turning point in history. The future of our country may very well depend upon what we do with our natural resources in the next few years. Well, in the beginning, man had only his own energy to use in his struggle for life. And this came mostly from the food he ate, about 2,000 kilocalories per day, or about the power consumed by a 100-watt light bulb. Many of the world's people still exist at this level or below, but in the U.S., per capita use is approximately 100 times greater. The 4 billion people in the world use about 7 times 10 to the 19th joules per year, or about 6 billion kilowatts of power, an average of 15 of these 100-watt light bulbs per person. The 200 million people in the U.S. use about one-third of the total, or about 116 of these 100-watt bulbs per person. This first graph shows the energy use per capita as against the gross national product per capita. And you notice that the U.S. Has a very high gross national product per capita, but also the energy use per capita is very high. And, pardon? I don't think you need to, Barb. Can you see it? Can you read it? way up where the halo is. So that any country which used energy in relation to its gross national product proportionate to the U.S. would lie along the dotted line at the center. So the countries which are to the left and above that dotted line are somewhat more efficient in the use of energy than we. Countries which lie below and to the right are somewhat less efficient in the use of energy as compared with the gross national product. Notice that many of the Eastern European countries tend to be rather energy intensive, but their gross national product is quite low. Of course, the emerging countries of the world, if we put them all together, they'd be crowded down in this corner. There isn't room enough to write but a small fraction of them. All we can do is put a lot of dots down there. And so a good portion of the world would be down in this quarter. Well, actually, the U.S. has always been an energy-intensive country. In 1850, U.S. consumption of energy was about 4.5 kilowatts per capita, but the worldwide average was about 0.4 of a kilowatt, less than 1/10 as much. Of the energy used in the U.S., 2/3 was supplied by draft animals. Only 1/9 came from fuels, mostly wood in those days. Per capita energy consumption today is a little more than twice of what it was in 1850, long before the first oil well was drilled. From its beginning, the U.S. has been a very energy-intensive country. And in fact, most of this increase, the fact that we use twice as much energy per capita now as we did 120 years ago, most of that increase has come in the last 3 decades or so. And we'll talk later on in the talk, we'll speculate or examine some of the reasons why this increase in the post-World War II era. Growth usually takes place in one of three ways. There'll be just a little bit of physics in this talk and a little bit of mathematics. Physics will be a little thermodynamics. The mathematics will be to remind you what is meant by exponential, linear, and quadratic growth, because I think these are very important to understanding what's happening in the world's energy utilization. I've illustrated three types of growth here: linear, quadratic, and exponential. Linear is where the growth is at a constant rate, so the amount used or whatever is growing, the y, is proportional to time. It's a straight line plotted as a function of time. Quadratic growth has a steadily increasing rate. The rate of growth is proportional to time. That means the total amount being used goes as the square of time, quadratic in other words. But exponential means that the rate is proportional to y. The rate is proportional to what's already there. And that's the explosive growth of anything, whether it's the rate of growth of bacteria, or whether it's compound interest in the bank, or whatever. As long as the rate increases in proportion to the amount that's there, then the curve will always go on stable regardless of what the constant C in the equation is. If you liken it to saving money, then if the a linear rate of saving would be to put 10 cents in the bank each month, then the rate of growth stays 10 cents per month, and at the end of 1 year you have $1.20 in the bank. Now, if you increase by 10 cents each month the amount that you put in the bank, then you put in 10 cents the first month, 20 cents the second, 30 cents the third, and so on. So the rate of growth is $1.20 per month. And at the end of the year, you're going to have $7.80 in the bank. But now the exponential growth is where you double the amount you save each month. So you save 10 cents the first month, 20 cents the second, 40 the third, 80 the fourth. And that takes off very rapidly. The rate of growth at the end of the year is 204.80, and the total savings at the end of the year is $409.50. That curve goes up rather rapidly. And characteristic of exponential growth is the doubling time, the amount of time that it takes to double, because you see that stays constant. Now, if you look down here in the left-hand column is the annual percentage of growth, and in the right-hand column is the doubling time. If the growth rate is 1% per year, then it takes 70 years to double. If the growth rate is 2%, it takes 35 years. If the growth rate is 3%, it takes 24 years. Now, energy use in the United States has doubled about 4 times this century. We're running somewhere around a 20-year doubling time. Well, you see, that's only a 4% growth rate. And a 4% growth rate is far below our rate of inflation. It's not a spectacular growth rate in the gross national product. But yet, this leads to doubling of the amount of energy four times in a century. And the problem, you see, in exponential growth is even when the doubling time is fairly modest, like it is in this country, when you're against a finite resource, any exponential graph will hit its head on the ceiling very soon. And it's just a matter of how long is the doubling time. For instance, supposing we had some bacteria, let's say, that doubles, that multiplies by dividing. You know, bacteria, the cell divides, and you end up with two bacteria, and then the two become four, and the four become eight. That's an exponential growth. Supposing it took 1 minute for the, on the average, for the cell to divide. Okay, supposing we put one bacterium in the bottle at 11 a.m., then by noon we'd find the bottle is full of bacteria. We'd have had 60 doubling times. We'd be up in the billions and billions of bacteria. We won't worry about exactly how many bacteria are in the bottle, but just remember that by noon it's full. Well, when was the bottle half full? Well, the answer is 11:59, 1 minute before noon. Now, if you were an average bacterium in the bottle, at what time would you first realize that you were running out of space? Well, there's no unique answer to this question. At 11:55 a.m., when the bottle is only 3% full, only 3% is filled, and 90% is empty, how many bacteria would perceive that there's a problem? Suppose that at 11:58, some foresighted bacteria realize that they're running out of space in the bottle, and consequently, with great expenditure of effort and funds, they launch a search for new bottles. They look offshore and in the Arctic, and by 11:59 a.m., they've discovered three new empty bottles. Great sighs of relief come from all the world's worried bacteria, because this magnificent discovery is three times the number of bottles that had hitherto been known to exist. The discovery quadruples the total space resource known to the bacteria. Surely this will solve the problem so that the bacteria can become self-sufficient in space. The bacteria project independence must now have achieved its goal. Well, how long can the bacterial growth continue now since they've quadrupled the amount of space? Well, the answer is two more minutes. They now don't get in trouble until 12:02. So you see, quadrupling the resource extends the life of the resource only by two doubling times. And as long as you have an exponential growth, you're going to get in serious trouble. The only question is, how soon? Well, now, there's a lot of talk about zero growth. Now, of course, zero growth solves a lot of problems. But I'm not really convinced that we need to go to a zero growth. But we have to get out of the off the exponential binge. I think that even a quadratic growth of modest constant proportionality see how technology might be able to support this. And I hope we can get a discussion. The other night I challenged John Schramm a little bit on this question of whether technology is what causes pollution, or whether it's the lack of technology, and I'd still like to argue for that. But as long as the technology stays ahead of the growth rate, you can stay out of, or you can avoid serious trouble. But whether you advocate a zero growth rate, or a finite quadratic or linear growth rate, or at least we've got to get off the exponential rate. That will get us in serious trouble. Okay, that's the problem. What about the strategy? What about the solution? Well, I've divided the strategy into four parts, and this is food for a whole semester's course in energy conservation. I certainly won't get the chance to touch on a few of these this afternoon. But I have a four-pronged approach, strategy for approaching the problem. One is developing technology. Another is planning, so that we don't run out of bottles. Another is change in lifestyle. And fourth is to limit the growth in some reasonable way. Now I'm going to probably talk a little bit more about technology than the other four, but perhaps in the discussion we can touch on points of interest throughout the rest of it. So that's the mathematics. Now the physics. I want to review or view, whichever the case may be for individuals, the second law of thermodynamics, because again, that's a point, a very fundamental point that's often overlooked or often misunderstood. Okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Can you read it now? Yeah, it's too bad we can't turn off the one bright light in front of the screen, but if we turn that off, then the whole room is dark, and then I'll have you all sleeping here. We can't afford that. All right. Heat engine is diagrammed here. And of course, this is the prototype, this is the thermodynamic prototype for all sorts of energy conversion devices. The basic heat engine converts heat to mechanical work. And it does so by taking its heat from the upper reservoir at a temperature T1, at the high temperature, and converting some of that energy to work and exhausting some of it to the low temperature reservoir, T2. Now, it would be nice if you could eliminate this heat Q2 that goes to the lower reservoir, but that is impossible. That's what the second law tells us, that we can never get 100% conversion efficiency in any kind of a heat engine device. The best we can do is approach the theoretical limit, which is given by the difference in temperatures, T1 minus T2, divided by the temperature of the lower reservoir. That should be T2, I'm sorry, not T1. And that's the best we can do. That's the best we can approach. All right, think of this now as an electrical generator. We burn fuel, and whether it's coal or oil or uranium fuel, and produce a hot reservoir, T1. From that hot reservoir, we take a certain amount of heat, Q1, and we convert it to electrical energy. That's our W. And we must exhaust waste heat. Well, clearly then, the only way you can really increase the efficiency of a heat engine of any kind is to make the difference in temperature T1 over T2 greater. And T2 will usually be ambient temperature. You can see right away why power companies would rather exhaust their waste heat into a lake or a river than into the ambient air, because that makes T2 somewhat lower and gives them a little greater efficiency. You'd like to operate your boilers at the highest temperature you can, but here safety becomes a factor. You can only operate a steam system at a certain amount of pressure. For safety reasons, we've limited the temperatures at which we run nuclear reactors to well below the theoretical limit of efficiency. All right, a heat pump then is just the opposite device. That's the prototype of a refrigerator or an air conditioner or a heat pump device to use to heat your home. In a heat pump, the heat is going from the colder reservoir to the hotter one. You're pumping heat uphill. And in order to do that, the second law tells you exactly how much work you have to expend, at least this much. So the work in this case will probably be electrical energy or mechanical energy in, and if you're thinking of this as a refrigerator, then this will be the interior of the refrigerator where you store your food, and you're taking heat out of that and exhausting it to the room, to a higher temperature in the room. If you're using a heat pump to heat your house, the T1 will be your house, and the T2 will be the reservoir from which you take your heat. So again, you see, you gain an efficiency if you take the heat from a reservoir that's at a warmer temperature. So a heat pump that draws heat from an underground well at 40 or 50 degrees Fahrenheit, even during the winter, will be a more efficient device than one which operates with its cold reservoir being the outside ambient air, which if you're from Minnesota, might be 40 below. If you're from somewhere else, it won't be quite so severe. But you've got to pump the heat uphill. Okay, so that's the limitations on any kind of energy conversion device that the second law of thermodynamics gives us. Well, let's look a little bit at the efficiency of certain devices. Let's look at efficiency of energy conversion. All right, there are two efficiency figures in this chart of numbers. The one is the efficiency of actual conversion, the other is the efficiency of fuel use. For example, I can illustrate the difference with electrical resistance heating. Electrical resistance heating, in converting electricity to heat, is very efficient, very nearly 100% efficient. But you've got to figure that in generating the electricity from fossil fuels or from uranium or from water power or whatever, the 60 to 70% of the fuel energy content was lost in the conversion process. So the net conversion from coal to heat in your house is only 30 to 40%, but most of that loss came in the generation and transmission of the electricity. So that's why two figures. A gas furnace is probably 75 to 85% efficient. So if you're comparing electric resistance heating to a gas furnace, you've got to multiply these two figures together. I'm sorry, that's already been done in the last column. You've got to consider the total efficiency, 30 to 40% against 75 to 85% efficiency here. Even though once the electricity reaches your home, the conversion is very, very high. Okay, because you're getting more heat out than the work in. I'll go back to the diagram of the heat pump again. For every kilocalorie, or let's say joule, of work you put in, you may get 1.5, 2, 2.5 joules of heat in the house because the rest was drawn out of the cold reservoir. Not at all, because in order to get this W, you've got to somehow convert fuel into work. Now, if you're running your heat pump with electricity from the power company, then you see that they're going to lose in generating electricity, but you're going to gain in running the heat pump. So the net may not be above 100, it can be above 100 because their thermodynamic process is fairly efficient. But now if you're using some other fuel, if you're running this heat pump with a natural gas combustion engine, for example, which is something I'd like to see developed, then it's easy to go well over 100%. Well, or the energy that I'm taking out of the outside air, I'm not counting, right? Right. I am in fact. Oh, sure. You can never get over 100% efficiency if you consider the universe. But the fact that I'm cooling the outside air from 30 degrees below zero to 31 or 32 degrees below zero, I'm not considering endless. I'm considering, yeah. Who tells you? Well, your efficiency drops because T2 then is much lower. And so your efficiency begins to drop. It may very well. I'd be surprised if it would drop below, say, the equivalent efficiency of electric resistance heating. But it could be. Theoretically, you ought to be able to construct a heat pump that would operate at least one and a half times multiplication rate, and I think it would be better than that.
Yeah.
Now, you see, you can get a tremendous gain, however, if you design your heat pump so that you're taking the, instead of the heat out of 40 degree below zero air, you're taking it out of 40 or 50 degree groundwater. Then you get a tremendous pump station. In fact, there are many. You can dream up all kinds of systems. The system that was put in many, many years ago, two and a half decades ago at Southdale, up in Minnesota, had two large underground storage reservoirs. And so during the summer, they they took heat out of the buildings and heated up one reservoir. And then they used that for their heat sink, for their heat pumps, or their heat source for their heat pumps in the winter. So really what they were doing was pumping heat back and forth between the two reservoirs. And this leads to a very efficient system, but of course the cost then of building these two reservoirs has to be considered. If you have access to a plentiful supply of groundwater, then you probably are going to want to just use that and take heat out of it in the winter and put heat into it in the summer. But there are many ways, you see, that you can operate with a storage reservoir that is much better than using the ambient outside air. It becomes a matter of design and economics. But we're going to see a lot more heat, use of heat pumps in the near future, certainly. Well, going down the line here, we'll get back to some of these again. Home appliances are notoriously inefficient. Lighting is kind of an interesting thing. The incandescent light, of course, is very, very inefficient. When we consider the total light output compared with the total amount of electrical input, most of the output of a light bulb is heat. And only a very small part of it is radiated as visible light in the small band of electromagnetic frequencies to which our eyes are sensitive. Now, there are a number of types of lighting that are much more efficient than incandescent lamps. Fluorescents run 5, 6, 7 times more efficient. And some of the newer high-efficiency lamps, like the halogen quartz lamps and the mercury and sodium arc lamps, are even more efficient. Now, for most home use, you don't want to use mercury and, I shouldn't say you don't want to use, but people aren't used to using mercury and sodium because of the color is not balanced in the same way as an incandescent lamp. But the quartz halogen lamps have pretty much the same spectral content as ordinary incandescent lamps. Transportation, there's a lot of room for improvement. In fact, to plot our strategy, we probably ought to look and see where most of the energy goes and zero in on some of the largest consumers of it. At the top, I've drawn two graphs, one which shows the source. At the present time, of course, most of our energy comes from fossil fuels. The amount that's produced by hydroelectric power is less than 4%. The amount that's produced by nuclear power is well under 1%. Now, the utilization is about equally divided between residential, commercial, industrial, and transportation uses. But probably more interesting than the total use is this chart at the bottom, which sort of breaks it down. We get four times as many figures in by making a little chart like this, a matrix. And you notice that in residential energy utilization, space heating is by far the largest portion of it. Electricity is a good deal less. Whereas in the industrial sector, it's just the other way around. Electricity is a very large use. Other heating includes process heat, steam and drying, and all the heat that's used in the industrial process itself. That's a big one. And transportation, of course, almost all of it is motive power. That's a fairly large chunk. These figures are given in units of 10 to the 12th kilowatt hours, and these are from 1967. They're fairly old figures. The figures for electricity include the conversion and transmission losses. These are in thermal input to the utility company. The graph, I don't want to throw too many figures at you here. This is another graph that sort of tells us where we are, the total energy consumption. You see a graph like that, it looks like it is an exponential growth, which in fact it is, but the population, you see, is on an exponential curve. So again, as I said early in the talk, we've always been an energy-intensive country. And the rate of energy utilization per capita hasn't gone up that altogether fast. But the total amount used does. Well, one place that it would be nice to use energy more efficiently is in the transportation sector. And in this set of figures, we've presented the amount of energy, or the in the case of the passenger moving, the number of passenger miles per gallon of fuel. In the case of cargo at the right, the number of cargo ton miles divided by the amount of fuel. In terms of passenger utilization, the automobile isn't too much different than a jet aircraft. And of course, one of the reason for that is that is our habit of loading automobiles with only a 1.25 to 1.5 persons on the average. There are a tremendous number of automobiles on the road with only one person. So the automobile figure could be considerably greater if the load factor increased. Trains are many times more efficient than automobiles. Buses slightly more efficient than trains. But when it comes to moving cargo, the figures are pretty dramatic. An airplane, even making 100% use of its cargo space, is a pretty inefficient way of moving cargo, as certainly you surmise. A train, a truck, or a barge tow, or a pipeline are much more efficient means. Yet, the fastest growing factors in cargo movement are air freight and trucks. The least efficient are the ones that are growing utilization fastest. Well, of course, it's a convenience factor, tremendous convenience factor. And up till now, people haven't worried about the energy utilization. It's been a matter of economics, and economics, of course, dictates the fastest moving of goods that you possibly can. Well, let's see, we're getting on with time here, and I want to reserve some time for discussing these things, but here's kind of an interesting, here's some interesting data on food and energy. The average American uses three times as much energy to bring food to the table as the average citizen of a developing country uses for all purposes. Energy use in the food chain can take many places along the process. One is fuel for tractors, trucks, and other vehicles. One is energy to make fertilizer, and fishing nets, and all the materials that you need to create food. And the energy that's going into to making fertilizer is just a prodigious amount. The increase is very, very rapid as we go from as we go to a fertilizer-intensive type of agriculture. I sometimes think that out in Illinois, at least, the farmers are using the soil pretty much as a catalyst to hold all the chemicals. It's really chemical farming. The nutrients, the weed killers, and all these things that are put on the plant. And of course, they get prodigious yields. They get several, 4 or 5 times the yield their ancestors got using without these chemicals. But these chemicals are very, very energy intensive, especially the fertilizers. The energy to process the food. Here again, it's a convenience factor, the freezing, the drying, and so on, the packaging and transportation. Well, there's a great difference in the amount of energy per calorie of output. If we divide the energy, total energy input into different types of food by the caloric output, the calorie output, we get a wide range of numbers, all the way from lobster here, 160 times as much input energy as output energy, down to bakery bread, which is pretty energy efficient. If everyone in the U.S. were to substitute a pound of perch or sardines for a pound of beef once a month, we'd save over 100 million barrels of oil per year. Fish are very, very energy, very, very efficient, of course, because you don't have to dump fertilizers and things of that sort. The only energy cost is the cost of operating the fishing fleet and taking them out of the ocean. You say, canning things certainly increases the energy content, the energy input, but that's not always true, because fresh vegetables and fruit have to be transported, and it takes, they're bulkier. If you can the fruit or dry it or in some way process it, sometimes the saving in transportation may more than make up for the process. Comparing, say, fresh oranges in this chart to canned pineapple. The fresh oranges actually consume or take more input energy per food unit than canned pineapples because of this transportation factor, largely. But the canned sardines and perch come out very, very well on this energy comparison. Conservation in the kitchen. Well, baking uses 6 or 8 times as much energy as surface cooking. Oh, sure. Well, here again, these are ballpark figures, because of course it depends upon how you cook on the surface. If you put a small pot on a large burner, the heat loss is very, very light. Heat transfer is not very great. But let's say under best conditions, or under normal conditions, the heating up an oven to do a dinner is a great convenience factor, but it's not a very efficient use of energy. Storage in a home freezer requires 30 to 40 times as much energy as commercial storage. And that, of course, is, again, a simple law of physics. If you have a body at a certain temperature, the rate of heat loss is proportional to the surface area, whereas the rate of the amount that you can store goes as the volume. And so if you double all the dimensions, you quadruple the surface area, but you multiply the volume by 8. So the larger the volume, the more that you maintain at a low temperature, at a below freezing temperature, the more efficient it's going to be. Plus the fact that commercial refrigeration systems tend to be more efficient than home systems. But it's mainly just the size of it. And so storing things in a home freezer, buying in quantity to save, may not indeed save either energy or money. Certainly doesn't save energy. Pressure cooking, frost-free refrigerators versus non-frost-free refrigerators, and things like that are factors that you may want to consider in the kitchen. The total energy utilization in the home, of course, is still overwhelmingly in the direction of space heating. But the proportion used for some of the other things, like refrigeration and air conditioning, are where the great rates of increase are. The space heating still accounts for over half of the energy utilization at home. And I would hope that in the future, nobody will build a house that without giving special consideration to making it energy efficient. Incorporating as much passive solar heating into it as they possibly can, and so forth. Now, but retrofitting a house is not an easy thing to do. It depends on the house. So we're not going to see a lot of change in space heating throughout the useful lifetime of present housing, which certainly is the order of 50 to 60 years. You can't go out and burn down all the energy efficient houses and replace them with the energy efficient ones tomorrow. This is something that takes time. Well, as I say, there are so many facets to this problem, so many things that one can consider that one has to, in a brief presentation like this, one has to sort of pick and choose and just try to whet your appetite. Now,